Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
I'm so excited to tell you a bit about today's sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, Music Masters Collective hosts different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Bill Frisell, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Julian Lage, Mark Ribot, Wayne Krantz, Oteil Burbridge, the Milk Carton Kids, and so many more. At an event like Alternative Guitar Summit Camp happening this August, you can expect in-depth workshops with guitar masters, once-in-a-lifetime performances, the opportunity to play alongside your favorite musicians, and a lot of fun. You'll leave this event packed full of wisdom and with a whole community of musicians to create with. This all-inclusive week in the Catskills Mountains of upstate New York is guaranteed to be magical. Scholarships are available, but spots are extremely limited, so visit www.alternativeguitarsummitcamp.com/inside to learn more. Hey guys, you're listening to Inside the Musician's Brain. Welcome back. I'm your host, Chris Pandolfi from the infamous String Dusters, and we are coming at you today with episode 5. Got a lot of good stuff lined up today. I'm going to field a bunch of String Duster-related questions. I saw a lot of questions about the songwriting process as well as the recording process and also arranging songs for the live show. So I'm going to kind of look at the arc of a song from inception through arrangement, the recording studio, and then how those songs make their way into the performance and in some cases even get rearranged for the show. And if you guys want to be a part of the conversation and submit questions, you can check out String Duster's social media, Facebook and Instagram, or you can check out my social media as well. I'm Trad Plus on Instagram. I'm easy to find. And I would love to know what you guys are interested in. I'm going to hit as many of those topics as I possibly can here in the podcast intro. So drop me a line and let me know what's up. And then when we get through all that String Duster stuff today, I'm going to roll part one of a really interesting interview I did recently here in Denver with my good friend Bill Nershey from the String Cheese Incident. Those guys are just wrapping up their 25th year as a band, which is incredible. They've been a huge inspiration to everyone around our music world. And Billy let me in on a lot of the inner workings of Cheese, and it's just a lot of juicy stuff. So we'll have part one today. We'll roll part two later in the season. Real quick, before we get into all this good stuff, I want to mention that Inside the Musician's Brain is a part of the Osiris Podcast Network, and there's just a ton of great stuff over there at Osiris. Great podcasts, great hosts. Make sure you guys check that out. Okay, so I dug into the social media mailbox for this episode because the last few episodes I got into the bluegrass history thing, and then I was talking about What the Night Brings, which is a very timely subject and also very relevant to everything that we've been talking about so far. But today we're going to get really heady on the String Dusters' songcraft, and we're going to look at how each song has a unique journey from inception all the way to the live show and how we all work together to make that process happen. So for the String Dusters, most songs are born as we're getting ready to make a new album. Yeah, there are certain instances where songs come online between albums, but when it's time to record, we need a bunch of new songs and we need our best stuff for our new record. So time has passed since we last hit the studio, and guys are writing songs because that's what we do. Now, most of that writing process starts on an individual basis. So we're all working on things individually. Now, in certain cases, we collaborate from very early on in that process. And actually, later on in the intro, I'm going to give you a little sort of demo of how the song Planets went from a seed of an idea that I had, and then I handed it off to Travis. He tweaked some chords, added the lyrics, we arranged it as a band, and recorded it, and then rearranged it and added a whole jam section at the end when it came into the live show. So we'll get to that demo in a second, but the songwriting process mostly starts on an individual basis. So guys are writing songs and we're starting to dial things in as we look ahead to making a new album. And typically we'll start sending ideas to each other over email so we can begin familiarizing ourselves with each other's material. And then ultimately we get together for what we call pre-production. We rent a house somewhere, we seclude ourselves, no gigs, and we just focus really deeply on the music. And in the first phase of pre-production, we're sort of showing things to each other and coming up with basic arrangements of them, not getting too deep into the instrumental parts or reworking the songs. We're just trying to kind of get a handle on how it would sound as a String Duster song. And that's sort of taking us to the next step where we're going to pick which songs are actually going to go on the album. And this used to be a more arduous process for us. And part of that is because we have so many writers in the band. But, you know, one cool thing that the Dusters have figured out is we share all of our songwriting credits. And that philosophy is really born of the idea that being in a band, it takes so many different things to make it go. Why should the songwriting process be weighted disproportionately from a financial standpoint to all these other really important things that make the business grow and make the music come alive? So it was great. I think once we started sharing songwriting credits, that competition factor around, oh man, I need to get my song on the album, kind of went away and allowed us to really focus on what's the best music. And as we go through this part of the process, we're trying to get our heads around not only what are the best songs, but what group of songs will work best together to comprise an album. Now, some bands come into this process with like 30 songs and cut it down to 10. For us, we usually have a handful to spare, but not too many. Of course, everyone brings their A-game material, and you know, it is tough to cut the songs that aren't going to make the record, and they usually see some sort of life in the live show, but we work the songs up enough so that we can make basic recordings of them and then say, okay, these are the ones that we want to record. So then we've got a focused batch of songs. Then we're going to actually get deep into the arrangement process. And this is one of the most fun and rewarding parts of being in a band. For me, this is where the art and the vision come to life. And again, we go for a pre-production session. Usually we rent a house somewhere, we spend anywhere between 2 and 4 days, and we take the songs and we just really give them a lot of time. And a lot of what's going on during this phase of things is guys are figuring out, how can I create an instrumental part on my instrument that will serve this song best? And how will it work with everything else that's going on to bring this song to life in a meaningful way? And sometimes it's more of a bluegrass treatment, and then sometimes it's not a bluegrass treatment at all. But, you know, this is where, like I say, the vision of the band really gets executed, and we hone these songs in to the point that we have them basically ready to record. And in the past, we would play songs live that would later end up on an album, but with recent albums, we've kept everything under wraps until the album actually comes out. And we've loved doing that because we just noticed that it builds all this excitement leading into a new tour, new album comes out, and with our type of fans who come to a bunch of shows every year, there's this great incentive to come out and see all this new music, and boom, it all hits the show all at one point, sort of infusion of energy and new material, and it's really cool, really invigorating, and you can see it reflected in the shows. And you know, it's one of the best reasons to put an album out. There's a lot of debate about, are albums a valuable thing anymore? So many artists just do singles, but we're real believers in the album, and I would say that that is first and foremost an artistic thing. For all those reasons I just mentioned, it's what moves the music forward, and I love that, and I'm always excited when we have a new album drop, and here we come for these live shows with all these new tunes, and it's like, let's see where this takes us. And it's an exciting moment on the tour. It really freshens things up. But of course, before all that goes down, we need to actually make the album. So we've got the songs, we head into the studio, and the process there has become a lot simpler for us over the years. We're really looking for live takes. You know, we're trying to capitalize on the experience that we have together playing as a band. We're not trying to polish things too much. We're just looking for that live energy of the instruments and the voices all working together to present that song with as much feeling as we possibly can. So we'll play a song. Sometimes it's two times, sometimes it's five or six. And we spend time in the control room at the studio trying to decide which is the most compelling take. Once we've got that picked, we'll go in and make fixes to little instrumental things if need be. And then we'll go in and add the lead vocals and the harmonies after the fact. So then we've got our songs recorded, and then we got to sequence the record, put the songs in order as they will appear on the album. And for Rise Sun, we actually did an interesting thing where we sequenced the record before we even went in to record. So we took every song, wrote it down on a note card with kind of the key and the vibe, and then shuffled things around and ultimately laid them out in what we thought was the most compelling sequence. And that was it. The album was done. That's kind of the recording process in a nutshell. So then we've got the album coming out. Then it's time to start thinking about how these songs will come alive at the show. So some songs on the record, like, for example, Coming Again, that's got a jam section in it where Andy gets to take off on the dobro and we sort of follow him until he wraps up whatever he's got to say, at which point he cues us, and then we use our little device there, which is actually a singing part that comes in, and that's leading us to the end of the song. Now, other songs like Wake the Dead, for example, we recorded it one way, but we started experimenting with it live and found out that it was a great candidate for a jam section at the end. And again, it would be an open-ended section, and we would sort of follow each other. Falco kind of starts that off and then hands it off to the banjo in a pretty organic way, and then I cue the end instrumental riff that wraps up the song. So every song's got its own version of that. Some don't change very much at all, like Rise Sun, for example. We pretty much play it like it is on the record. But they all get their own treatment, and we're able to figure out through experimentation which ones will sound good with some extended improvisation or which ones are kind of better left untouched and, again, are represented as they are on the album. Now, to bring all that home and kind of give it a little context, I thought I'd bust out a quick demo here of the song Planets, which, of course, went through all these phases before it made its way into the live show. And this one actually started out with this simple riff on the banjo where I'm kind of mimicking the sound of like an electric guitar. So I handed that little musical figure off to Travis. He adapted that with a melody part and some lyrics, and that would become the verse when he was writing the song. And then in our band arrangement session, Andy Hall added a melody on the dobro, and that would become the intro and the verse to the studio version. And then once we had that recorded version, if you listen to the album, it sort of goes into this spacey section at the end, and we really dug that, but it didn't necessarily have a proper ending. So what we did was to adapt it to the live show. We would kind of go into this airy textural thing and then ultimately transition into another song, but we really felt like it needed one more layer of thought, and it was Andy Hall, actually, who suggested that we add the Ruben and Charisse jam that the Jerry Garcia Band used to do, and it was a perfect fit. And if you listen to the new live release, Live in Covington, great example, you can hear us kind of ease our way into Ruben and Charisse. That Ruben and Charisse jam starts to get really big. We kind of move away from the melody while still playing the chord changes, and then that melody comes back, and we cue a big release down to a D chord, and you kind of hear everything just chill out and settle down. it's at that point, after everything chills out, that we make our way on to the next song. And that's how the live version of Planets came to be, from a simple seed of an idea, a little riff on the banjo, through the songwriting process, into recording, and then a whole other layer of arrangement for the live performance. So a lot goes into every song, all these different phases of creation, and like everything we do, we're always trying to refine these different techniques and just find the best possible ways to bring new music to life. Okay, that's going to do it for the heady analytical string duster section of episode 5 of the podcast, and now I want to get on to my interview with the amazing Billy Nershey. I love this guy. I've had so many chances to make music with him, most notably back in the Emmett Nershey Band days. He, of course, is a founding member of the String Cheese Incident. He's a great guitar player, great singer, great songwriter, with so many interesting things to say about music, life on the road, and everything that's made Cheese go over the years. So here we go, Billy Nershey.
As I ramble around on the outskirts of town, visions from the past fill my mind.
All right, we're here on Inside the Musician's Brain, and I'm so excited about our guest today. This guy is a Jamgrass legend. He's the guitar player and one of the singers with the String Cheese Incident, and also a guy who I've been really lucky to collaborate and hang with many times over the years. Billy Nershey, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Yeah, man.
Hondo, can I call you Hondo?
You certainly can.
All right.
For a little context, Hondo is my nickname from our Emmett Nershey Band days.
Yep, from the Halloween.
That's right.
at the
Boulder Theater.
A cowboy outfit on. That's with right. The littlest cowboy hat I've ever seen.
That's right. Billy Nershey wouldn't take no for an answer that night.
No,
if you
that's
catch
right.
My drift. Thanks for doing this, man. Really been looking forward to this. And I want to kind of start out by talking about the roots and origins of Cheese. In the first few episodes of the podcast, I've definitely covered the history of bluegrass and the progression from traditional music through kind of the 70s, second generation guys, and then Newgrass Revival. And then we come to the 90s and Cheese comes around, and there was very little precedent for what you guys ended up doing. You know, there weren't that many bands playing bluegrass related music in clubs, selling hard tickets with this vision that it could be scaled up. So I'm wondering, when you guys got rolling, who were your influences? You know, who were the bands that you were looking at, both musically and also in a business sense, saying, oh wow, you know, this thing that hasn't necessarily been done before could possibly be done, and be done even on a bigger scale. Who were your early influences in those capacities?
Well, right when we were meeting in Crested Butte, you know, where I had known Keith from various, seeing him at various bluegrass festivals, Telluride, Rocky Grass in Lyons, and other festivals, and we had done a little picking and talking, and you know, he was in Crested Butte, I was in Telluride. I met Mike Kang in Crested Butte, and he was influenced by, he liked bluegrass, and he also played jazz and different things. He was mainly a fiddle player at that point, played some mandolin also. For sure, and a little bit of guitar. When we started playing music as a four-piece, I think that a lot of our influences were, say, Telluride Bluegrass Festival. If you go to a full weekend of Telluride Bluegrass Festival, you're apt to see a lot of different kinds of music, not just bluegrass. There'll be some jazz, and there'll be some rock, and there'll be these different styles of music being played. You know, some of the bands that stood out were, any chance we got to see Newgrass Revival, that was a big thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because the musicianship was at such a high caliber. They were playing on with bluegrass instrumentation, but they were playing compositions that were you know, bluegrass and the fringes of bluegrass and beyond. We also would really enjoy watching the Grisman Quintet play, you know, because same thing. They would play some bluegrass, but they would also play a lot of Latin, Brazilian, lots of these other styles. And it's like, well, that's cool. You know, these guys, not only are they great players, but they choose some really interesting compositions.
For sure.
Because, you know, I'm a bluegrass lover. And but at the same time, it's nice to pepper in some different styles to keep the ears perked up and keep it interesting, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah, for sure. I mean, bluegrass, especially if you look at what's going on today, I think is a result of the evolution of the music and the mixing in of all those different styles and the different directions that bluegrass has gone is a result of that. And you guys are such a huge influential piece of that whole progression. And it's interesting you mentioned Newgrass Revival because they're such an incredible band musically. There was nothing like them before they came around. But even Newgrass never really had a lot of traction, like touring. I've talked to Bela about the fact that it wasn't necessarily that easy to sell tickets and sell tickets in clubs because fans just weren't aware that this thing was going on. They weren't necessarily looking for it. But you guys, you know, Salmon formed, I think, like in 1989, and you guys were just a few years after that. But that apparently didn't stop you. You sort of jumped right into that abyss and said, you know, we're going to play this music, but we're going to take it out on the road and play shows, even though no one had ever really done that before.
I think when we first started playing music, we were not thinking at all about how are we going to have commercial success.
Right.
We were just thinking about what's the coolest music that we've heard or can create that will, you know, will make us feel like we're doing something that we like, we enjoy. We weren't saying, you know, well, what do the people want to hear? You know, what's gonna work if we tour, and how, you know, we were thinking in two separate ways. We were thinking about what kind of music do we play? What's interesting to different people in the band? Let's learn it and play it as well as we can. And then we were thinking in another part of our brain. This is inside
the musician's brain.
This is all happening inside my brain. I'm trying to get it out through my mouth. So one aspect was, let's create really fun music that we're really psyched on. And the other part was, how are we going to succeed as a band? And we took models of bands that did the same similar things before us and succeeded. We never expected to have a hit song, you know. Yeah, so it's like, well, how do these bands that don't have hit songs create a good fan base? And so,
right,
of course, we looked at The Dead and we looked at Phish,
sure,
for that kind of a model, for our touring model.
Yeah.
Musically, we're driving around. Maybe we have Bussy at this point. We got in 98, maybe.
Bussy was your touring vehicle.
Was our touring vehicle. It was a Crested Butte transit bus.
That's right.
That we bought from the ski area and took the seats out and made bunks and a couch area and turned it into a touring bus, which was not very expensive, and it got us out of those terrible passenger vans that can crush a band.
Oh, I know them well. I know them well.
So we know we have to cover a lot of regions touring, and at the same time, we're listening. We've got the music that we're playing, and we're listening to ARU, and we're listening to Del McCoury, and we're listening to Latin jazz bands, and we're listening to all Hot Rise. And
ARU, by the way, Aquarium Rescue Unit, one of the most legendary, I guess, jam band, or just a breeding ground for amazing musicians. Colonel Bruce Hampton, O'Teal, Matt Mundy, Jimmy Herring. Right. Really influential on, it seems like, everyone who's out there doing anything that's related to jam music.
It was the right combination of different kinds of music. You know, there was blues, there was some incredible musicianship, you know, with Matt Mundy and Jimmy Herring. You know, and there was just crazy, incredible lyrics by Colonel Bruce, who was just channeling. Channeling some higher power.
He was one in a zillion, that guy.
Yeah. So that band had a lot of influence on us. And Newgrass Revival, you know, we had the Telluride sessions.
Oh yeah.
Which, if you haven't heard that, that is a stellar recording of some incredible compositions, with Edgar Meyer on the bass and Sam Bush on the mandolin, Bela Fleck on the banjo, Stuart Duncan on the fiddle.
Oh, Mark O'Connor.
Mark O'Connor.
On violin and guitar.
I think, yeah. When they played live, sometimes there would be both of them or one or the other. But yeah, Mark O'Connor wrote some of those tunes and played not just the fiddle. Guitar, of course, he's won all, every instrument contest on every different instrument that you can: mandolin, mandolin, guitar, fiddle.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what else, but
yeah,
So that album was one of our top ones, and it got us into this point where that's the new normal bluegrass for us now. Yeah. You know, yeah, we love Del and Tim O'Brien and all these bands, you know, Ricky Skaggs. But then there is also this different kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody in the band had bluegrass roots, you know. Right. Like Travis is a Latin percussionist.
Right.
When he joined, you know, and
but you guys had,
you know, so we wanted to play that bluegrass, but we got to make it work for everybody in the band,
sure,
too. So it becomes something different.
Right. Which has been a theme for String Cheese over the years, how to incorporate all these different influences. But as far as the sort of the vision of what the band could be, you were looking at Fish and the Dead and sort of these grassroots fan base models from really early on. And that came to be a thing that has really defined you guys. Just the way that you treat your fans, the way that you interact with your fans, and it seems like that was sort of baked into what Cheese is from very early on.
Yeah, definitely, because you start out...
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil story made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Oh. Well, hey, friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask?
I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to the show on the road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon.
With the concept of, okay, how did those bands become successful? And it was by playing a lot of shows, going to a lot of regions, trying to make each show sound as good as possible. When we toured in the beginning, we would carry a small PA with us.
Right.
And we'd go into a club that had a crappy sound system, and we'd take it down and put ours up. This is when we were playing, it could be 150 people in the room.
But that was an important thing that was going on, in addition to the music evolving and coming into all these new zones. Technology, PA systems, lighting rigs were all getting significantly better at this time. And you guys actually carried your own PA from early on.
Yeah, we did. We had a trailer that we had behind Bussy, and we would have a small Meyer sound system with us. So a lot of times, if we didn't like the way the room, the sound system looked, you know, it was John O'Leary back then, and he would say, okay, we're taking it down and we're putting ours up, and the clubs would hate us, and the people would come in and they would say, I've never heard this room sound that good, you know. So we understand that these are our customers in effect, and the customer needs to leave the show happy.
Yeah,
and we're
sure.
trying to do things to do that. So we would travel. So that was a big part of how we started with the model from, you know, the Dead and Fish, you know. And the other part was, hey, we're gonna do a run on the West Coast, say, wherever it may be. This same group of people is gonna go to all of these shows, you know. There's at least a couple of dozen people that are on tour, or maybe more, you know, and then the people that live in the region. But for these people, we want to play a different, we want to keep changing the shows up. We can't just like play the same set list and, or even the same songs in different orders. You know, we have to make sure that that what we're playing each night is unique. What we called the incident, you know, each incident is unique and onto itself in each town that we played, and they'll be remembered by people as, you know, that show in, you know, up in Humboldt was different than that show they played in Chico or whatever,
right?
You know,
right.
And again, just trying to keep things interesting for everybody involved.
What about the sort of mainstream music thing, you know, did you ever potentially have a big record deal or have the goal of getting radio play, or was that ruled out from pretty early on?
I don't think we ruled it out, but other people may have. When we got to the point where we had our feet underneath of us and we had a regular touring thing going, we had some regions that we had succeeded in and had people coming out, and we had some regions that were harder to crack. But we were like, okay, we've been touring for a couple of years now pretty hard, and you know, what about the records? You know, we could maybe get a bunch of money for a record deal and then be on a label and make some money selling records. So we said, well, let's talk to some people about their record deals and different record labels and how they went for the bands. I remember a couple of specific things. I remember talking with Leftover Salmon, and they had a record deal going. They put out a couple of really good records. I forget which the label was right off the top of my head, but they had a negative experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to Butch Trux about the Allman Brothers.
Sure.
Hey, Capricorn, man, they put out a lot of really good records.
Right.
How much money are you making? Did you really, you know, how'd you do off of all those record
deals? Yeah, what did
he say? He said, I haven't made a dollar off of any of that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it hasn't hurt you guys any. I'll say that.
So, like, at that point, then we're like, okay, well, this, you know, we talked to a bunch of other bands that were, you know, at least at our level, or maybe, you know, had some more success at that point, you know, and really didn't have any good record label stories told to us at all.
Yeah.
So that's when we decided that we maybe we should just have our own record label, own our own masters, and sell it in, you know, with our own company, and we created Psy Fidelity Records.
Yeah. Well, like I said, it's interesting because it hasn't hurt you guys at all. You know, you've become a juggernaut in the jam world, despite not necessarily being able to tap into the commercial success. I think when people launch into a career in music, well, the game has really changed a lot these days, and it's much more DIY, and there are a lot more players in the game. The barrier to entry is a lot lower, but this was all going down when people were still buying CDs and listening to the radio.
It was on the cusp of the fall of the record companies.
Right, right.
You know, we were right on the cusp, and luckily we were we got enough good advice, and we were smart enough to go with the more modern model, which is do it in-house, create your own music, and really one of the most successful things for our record label has been the live CDs, on the road CDs. Every night we record off the board, a combination of off the board and an audience, the audience mics, and we create a matrix and do a quick mastering of the music, and each night is for sale as an the road CD or download.
Yeah,
you know, that's really where the record company has made the most money.
Yeah, and you guys probably stream all your shows as well.
We stream a lot of our shows now. I don't think every single one, but most of the major shows are streamed,
And it makes a lot of sense that even back in the day when the record industry it hadn't completely fallen apart like it has now, but you guys had this whole other thing going on. You know, you weren't like some up and coming act that was looking for a lottery ticket record deal. Like, you guys were out there playing shows, you had fans, you had a thing. And I think part of that decision comes down to, you know, we're not looking to sacrifice something that someone else needs to have a part of. It's like cheese is already going, and you guys knew what it was. And so that kind of evolved into creating Psy Fidelity, and now you guys have the SCI Sound Lab going.
And now we have the Sound Lab. We bought a building out from a friend of ours out here in the Denver area somewhere, it's like a building that was, it's a big building, 4,500 square feet, and it's like half of it is warehouse space and half of it is a recording studio, which we've, you know, invested a little bit into to really have a good control room and do some things to get the sound better in there and wire the place. So that,
store a lot of your touring gear there as well, right?
Yeah, so we have merchandise and touring gear,
right,
and all our stuff. Everything is under one roof right now, which it used to be we had a building to practice in, we had a building to keep our merchandise in, we had, you know, all these different things that we were renting, and none of them were really, you know, great for any of the things that we needed.
But it's also a full-on recording studio.
So it's full-on recording studio, and when we get together and rehearse, we are, you know, all we have to do is press a button. We have Dros, our sound man, is our engineer, and anytime we have an idea that we want to get down, everything is wired, and all we have to do is get the signal going and press the button, and we can record. And it makes us have the ability to say, this song right here is ready to go, and this is a great idea. Let's put down the basic tracks on this, and we can work on it later today, this week, or we can put it in the can and do overdubs on it later.
Right.
And then, hey, this song that we recorded 2 weeks ago is ready to be mixed, or it might need a track or two. But there's this flow going, and then another song is just being mastered now, and we're checking it to see if it's good, and it's good. Okay, we're going to release that later this week.
So you won't necessarily wait until you have a whole record of tunes. You can just
we've been checking it out. You know, we made a lot of albums. You know, the usual way, and now we've been checking out, releasing one song at a time. We have a song coming up that's going to be released this week that I wrote with Jim Lauderdale.
Oh, cool.
Stories for Another Day.
Awesome. Love Jim.
And then Jim flew into Colorado and came over to the lab.
Cool.
And the band and Jim, we all got together and we cut the song, and now we're ready to release it.
Yeah.
You know, so we're doing things, yeah, one song at a time, boom, pop it out there. Right. And then maybe at the end we can make a collection, an album of a group of songs that we've released that aren't on an album.
Yeah. It's cool. It's like one more way that you guys can just be essentially directly in touch with your fans. Make every decision about, okay, here's a new song. We want to record it. We don't necessarily want to wait for a complete album of songs. We just want to get this thing out there. And, you know, it's more music for them to check out.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Throwing them bone here and bone there, and then, you know, we put the song out. They're like, oh, hey, if we go to the show, maybe we'll get to hear them debut the song. You know, we're trying it that way right now, and it's been great. The best part about it, which is good for us and the fans, is that we've put out probably 14 new songs in the last year or so.
Yeah.
And so our set lists, we have a lot of songs to pull from available to us. We can do 6 or 7 nights in a row without repeating a song and feel like the set lists are strong. I'm not attached to having to play 7 nights of music in a row without repeating a song.
Are some guys in the band?
Yes.
And how do you guys work through something like that? It's obviously compromise.
Like, we went out on a tour recently and we played 7 nights without repeating songs, but some of us in the band felt like, hey, this could be stronger if we played some of the things that we're really up on right now instead of peppering in a lot of these nuggets that we haven't played for a while.
Right. It's the value of changing it up every night versus the value of playing material that maybe you think is stronger.
That could make for a stronger show, you know. But at that point, when we started going back and forth about it a little bit, it was the 7th night, and I said, you know, let's ride it out. Let's play, you know, not repeat. We're here at the 7th night.
Sure.
And you're talking about maybe repeating one song or 2 songs. Let's just play it out. And so we did that, you know. But then when that comes up again, we're still in the air about which is the way to go about it. Now, if you take that one fan or you take that group of fans that have been to 100 plus shows, some of them even more than that, you know, some of them 300 shows, God knows what's going on with that. But I don't know if you want to get inside their brain, inside the fan's brain. That's a whole...
That'll be your podcast. Good luck.
But then, you know, when you do something like that, they're the ones that'll say, damn.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. I was at all those shows, and they never repeated a song the whole time. Where does that come from? Well, Fish did that too.
Yeah.
Fish does that too. So, you know, we can't say that. We're not too proud to see somebody doing something interesting, another band doing something interesting and saying, hey. And we've always been like that.
Yeah.
You know, if, you know, we see musicians, whether it's the music playing or what they're doing on tour, you know, if that seems like, well, that's really cool, we might try it out, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know that. You know the super fans appreciate it, even if they're not there sometimes. You know, and that's a reality of the music world that we're a part of today. Is every time you guys play a show, it's so much more than just the people in the room. It's people streaming. Even if they don't stream, they look at the set list, and you guys do live recordings, and you play off this sort of new and noteworthy. When you do something like that, no repeats over 7 nights, it's a thing in this world that it gets people's attention. But I want to shift gears for a second, just talk a little bit about the musical progression of String Cheese, because you guys are such an incredible and eclectic brew of all these different influences. You know, one night you have David Grisman sitting in, the next night you have Skrillex sitting in at Electric Forest, and I think you're probably the only band that can claim that, by the way. And it's interesting, you know, you guys... if you ask me, I think you essentially started out as a bluegrass band, certainly derivative bluegrass instruments. Mm-hmm. And I can remember the first time I heard Cheese, Born on the Wrong Planet. I was living for the summer on Nantucket Island, working at a grocery store, just learning banjo. And I was over at my buddy John's house, and they were blasting Born on the Wrong Planet, and there was someone there who I'd been jamming with. I had my banjo out and I was playing along, music was cranking. Next thing you know, we turn around, two police officers standing in the room with us on the second floor of this condo, and there's like a 6-foot graphics bong sitting out with the big alien head at the base, and I mean, the cop rolls over, the stereo turns,
witnessing a cultural event.
That's right.
Were they dancing?
They were not dancing. They were not amused. One of the cops rolls over, turns the stereo down, and that night kind of went down in infamy. But I remember this was my first time that I'd been exposed to String Cheese, and it was great. I loved it. It was, you know, you guys were so innovative at the time, and these days this jamgrass scene is just thriving. It's incredible what all has come after that. But I'm curious to know, like, when did, you know, these days you guys have electronic elements, and you know, you obviously added Jason, and there's so much going on musically. When did those new influences start to come in? How did they come in, and how do you guys work through incorporating all that stuff?
It's not new. It's been the same thing that's been going on since we started playing. And Mike said, hey, you know, well, there was some original stuff that was, you know, different. Like I brought in, say, Texas, the song Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And I played it, and it was kind of this jazz exercise thing that I have been doing quarterly. And I wrote a story about my trip to New Orleans Jazz Festival and put it to the music. And when I brought it in, Trav was like, well, that's great. how about if we do it Latin? You know, so right there it was like, okay, Travis knows how to play Latin percussion, and he hears something in this, and Mike knows how to play jazz, which is kind of a little bit of the flavor and Latin. So it became a string cheese song that way because of people's influences. And Mike says, hey, let's play this song Aprovav, you know, which is a jazz standard. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I don't know how to play jazz, Mike. He said, well, you're going to learn.
I like it.
You know?
Yeah.
And so there's the beginning of it. And now, you know, it's always been like that. Kyle brings in a song that's, you know, like a Radiohead song. And it's like, well, how do we do this? You know, well, we're going to figure out. Let's listen to some music, you know, and figure out how to make it work. How do the other bands make it work? How do Radiohead make it work, you know?
So you just, you take each song and you just let that song be your guide. And then you guys pull from what you know as individuals and you say, okay, Texas has got this Latin vibe and certain guys have got a handle on that, and that sort of guides the evolution.
So say there's this song, Star of Munster. Okay, it's an old Celtic fiddle tune that I learned how to play. And so I play it for the band, and the band is like, oh, okay. And Jason says, well, you know, that sounds like Bollywood music, you know? And I'm like, what the hell is Bollywood music, you know? And he says, well, it's this kind of like Indian electronic thing that's going on. And he plays some of it. And then it's like, okay, let's take this melody and make it into this electronic thing. And the thing is, you know, it's like writing music with people or playing music, even sitting down and playing, picking a few tunes with people. When you start saying no or saying, I don't know how to do that, or, you know, then it's like a non-starter.
Yeah.
You know, when you write with somebody, you have to be always more leaning toward the yes side or let's check it out side.
Yeah.
You know,
especially if you're on a quest as a band, like you guys are, I know, like we are, to some extent as well, to satisfy everyone with the music.
Right.
And let everyone have and the minute you start saying no and you start closing doors, you sort of set a precedent that's can be hard to undo.
And that's like, you know, if Jason had said, hey, this sounds like Bollywood music, you know? And I said, well, it's not. You know, it's bluegrass, Jason. You know, if I had gone that route, it just shut down Jason. You know, it negates his energy that he can be giving to the band. And it's really kind of lame. So, you know, I'm like, okay, let's check it out, you know, and everybody had ideas. All of a sudden, everybody has ideas, you know, let's do this, let's do that, you know.
Cultivate and that yes it energy. Make,
all of a sudden, something good happens, you know, and we have a song now that's a regular part of our repertoire, and it's the Bali Monster, and it's a Celtic Irish fiddle tune that could be bluegrass song, is played as a bluegrass song by a lot of bands. But now since we have all these different influences in the band, it became something totally different. And that's been the precedent since the beginning of the band and to right now. And, you know, and it you know, it makes everybody feel like they're incorporated. It makes everybody feel like they're adding to what's going on.
Yeah, and that's a great.
When you get on stage, everybody's feeling like I'm an important part of this band. I contribute to this band on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of vibe that you want.
Yeah, it's a great approach to more than just a band, any group endeavor, you know, if you cultivate that yes energy and then people know that they have an outlet for whatever it is that's original to their voice. I'm going to hit pause right there on my conversation with Billy. I really love what he's getting into in that last part about bringing the yes energy and a spirit of open-mindedness to any collaboration effort. And that can really be extrapolated out well beyond the realms of music and playing in a band. Just a great life lesson right there. And there's so much more great stuff from that interview. I'll be airing part two of that later in this season of Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm going to get back to my bi-weekly Tuesday release schedule starting early in 2020, so keep your eyes peeled for episode 6, which features my interview with the incredibly cool and unique Holly Bowling from the band Ghostlight. She had a million cool things to say. I learned a ton from that one. Real quick reminder that Inside the Musician's Brain is a part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Check out Osiris. It is a trove of great music and culture podcasts. I'm sure you'll dig. All right, guys, thanks so much again for listening. I'm signing off for now, but we will be back in a few weeks with the next installment of Inside the Musician's Brain.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.